listening to PRN, number one for progressive minds.
Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. The topic today is U.S. versus China on the eve of the G20 meeting, which is next week in Buenos Aires. And Trump's going to meet President Xi. And supposedly, they're going to come to some agreement on the trade war. Well, actually, this is the threshold, the true threshold for the trade war, should it really erupt between China and the U.S. 50-50 chance. Why? Well, because you got the three factions in the U.S., and the third faction is holding firm. That third faction, of course, is the Pentagon and industrial military complex here that wants to stop and slow China developing next-generation technologies with great military implications to them. I'm talking about 5G wireless, cybersecurity, and artificial intelligence, also the industries of the future. So that faction, led by Robert Lighthizer, who heads the Office of U.S. Trade, anti-China advocate for some time, and Peter Navarro, another advisor on trade to Trump, who is anti-China. In fact, wrote a book called Death by China. And Bolton, who is a cold warrior there, neocon. All these now have the ear of Trump. And, of course, it's quite clear whoever gets to Trump gets to his ear last, turns him. And they've had him pretty much in their control on this trade issue with China for the last couple months. Before that, it was the other U.S. faction, the bankers and multinational corporations led by Steve Mnuchin, who is the Treasury Secretary in the U.S., who has attempted a couple times to assert control over the trade negotiations, but has been beaten back. And then the third group is the red state, heartland, agricultural, small business interests, small manufacturing. They just want the opportunity to sell more into China and to buy cheaper China intermediate goods. That would reduce the trade deficit significantly. Mnuchin banker crowd, they want more access to Chinese markets, which have a limit of 49% ownership by the U.S. And anybody else, any other foreign investors. That's all designed to prevent the repatriation of profits out of China back to whoever the home country is. That's what bankers do. So, you know, that's the second faction there. Actually, China had granted these first two factions big concessions already. China has said it would buy $100, $200 billion more of U.S. goods, mostly agricultural goods, of course. Big, big concession. And China had conceded to Mnuchin and the bankers by saying, look, we're going to give you 51%, and you know, we can talk about even giving you more control of your operations in China. Okay, so those two groups pretty much got what they want from China, but the group that hasn't is the technology group, the Pentagon, so forth. China is holding firm on that. In the meantime, the U.S. is has an offensive going to push Chinese investors out of technology-sensitive companies in the U.S., not allowing them to buy into these companies or pushing them out. ZTE Corp was a good example. A compromise was reached there earlier in the year. But These three are the contending. Now, Trump has been trying to get the Chinese to the table here for a couple months, and they're just refusing to come because they knew this would just be a ploy to make it look like he's acting tough before the November election. So they didn't come. And now we've, Trump is turning the screws, issuing threats at the same time, throwing softballs and accolades at Chinese President Xi here before he meets with them. Whether this meeting at the G20 next week in Buenos Aires is successful or not will depend on whether we see more accolades and softballs or whether we see the U.S. Doubling down. Really, there's only really up to now 50 billion on tariffs, with another 150 about to take form here January 1st. And China has also put its own 50 billion in and threatened some additional tariffs. And then Trump has even raised the prospect of another 267 billion tariffs, but that's just rhetoric right now. And we don't really get the 200 billion tariffs taking a real effect until January. So there hasn't really been a trade war there to date. There has been a trade skirmish, and it's like two fighters in a ring. They're circling each other, preparing to throw the punches. But it's just a couple of short jabs going on here so far. No one's thrown a hard right yet. But January 1st is sort of deadline date. And this opens the next round, this Buenos Aires thing. And we'll see whether they come out fighting they'll probably talk more about fighting because they got December to really come up with something. So that's where we really are. That's my interpretation. It's not a real trade war yet, but it's getting close to one. And, of course, there is no trade war with all the other allies. That's all nonsense. That's all, political posturing that the results, NAFTA and all that. Okay, so the New York Times came out with the beginning of a series of articles today, and it shows the role how the mainstream press really plays an ideological role here. It's not by accident. It comes out right before Trump goes to Buenos Aires here, because the New York Times is part of the liberal establishment press, is really aligned behind the Mnuchin faction here, and they're trying to influence the outcome here, whatever that might be in terms of trade. They've published the first of a series entitled The Land That Failed to Fail. In other words, China, see? The story, as the story goes, the myth goes here that in 1984, China made a big turn economically, and what were bureaucrats and communist apparatchiks got together in this mountain retreat and brought in a lot of new blood, young economists, right, and the old guard, and they came up with the whole new strategy for development. And as a consequence of that strategy today, according to New York Times, China has the largest number of homeowners, the largest number of internet users, the largest number of college grads, and has reduced extreme poverty to less than 1%. How they define extreme, I don't know, right? Over the last 30-some years, right? 30-some years of, 35 years of uninterrupted economic growth. But now we have an epochal contest underway between China and the U.S. So it asks, the New York Times asks, why did China succeed? And that's what this series is really about. But it really provides no explanation, you know, just a lot so far, a lot of anecdotal evidence of statistics and facts and so forth. There's no real, what was their development strategy? Well, we all know that they turned to manufacturing, you know, in economics, it's, you know, is it an import substitution strategy or is it an export-led strategy, blah, blah, blah. But that's at such a high level, doesn't tell you really all that much. One thing it points out, the article, was that the Chinese were really shaken by what happened with the USSR when it collapsed. And, you know, the USSR attempted the same thing in the 80s, but it attempted to open up and liberalize for all kind of competition its political system first. That was called, the Russians called that glasnost, right? And the economic restructuring was called perestroika. Okay, so political opening before economic reforms and economic restructuring, which turned out to be a disaster because it set off all those bureaucrats, those communist bureaucrats, hustling and maneuvering to make themselves the next billionaires and to make themselves, you know, the what we call the oligarchs today. Yeah, these oligarchs, they were all communist hacks and bureaucrats during the 70s and 80s, and then they became big capitalists. Well, glasnost kind of threw open the political system, which caused it to implode. And then, you know, a week later, you know, like Gorbachev and couldn't control it. The whole objective was perestroika. But they never got to that. And then the 1990s, when they imploded, the U.S. stepped in and made sure that they stayed on their knees economically. We had a terrible depression in Russia for at least a decade. And people don't understand that Putin kind of saved their water over there as far as economics is concerned. The old KGB, Putin, formed an alliance with the new oligarchs and got the country going again, particularly through oil, through the boom period of the first decade, global boom of this 21st century, and pretty much made an example of some of the oligarchs when they tried to step into politics, you see. They could make their billions, but the politics would be run by the old KGBers. Anyway, that whole event and the collapse of the USSR terrified China. So China flipped that strategy on its head. In other words, no glasnost, no political opening. We're going to stay with the one party, Communist Party, ruling the roost, but we're going to allow capitalists to form. Get rich is good, you know, was one of the mottos there. So we get this development of the Chinese economy, a historic development, even though we have a one-party communist state. And it's a strange mix. It's a new mix, but it's a strange mix. The question is, though, how did this work, you know, with China, to have a maintain a political Marxism ideology and state, even though they don't adhere to it that much, and economic capitalist development within a state-owned sector. You know, still a lot of state-owned enterprises in China. In fact, the whole industrial, the whole military production sector is owned by the state. Actually, it's owned by the Chinese People's Army. Yeah, they own their own factories over there. But, you know, it's kind of remarkable that they've been able to balance political Marxism and economic capitalism without either one really collapsing. A lot of adjustment, of course. Been able to promote nationalism without slipping into a war, particularly with the West in places. Been able to maintain political control, even repression sometimes, by and at the same time having economic innovation and entrepreneurship. You know, that balancing of these contradictions is an interesting accomplishment by the Chinese. So this system, this model, right, is now being confronted, confronted by the U.S. model, which has dominated the world. You know, the U.S. has a global empire, economic empire, and military as well. You know, it's got troops in 177 countries. So don't think it's not, you know, an economic, political, military empire. But the new kind of imperialism is not the British 19th to early 20th century form. It's an imperialism making the local domestic elites junior partners and letting those domestic elites run the show politically instead of the U.S. coming in and trying to maintain a bureaucracy as the British did and trying to control every little outbreak and so forth. They let the domestic elites do that, and the U.S. provides them the resources. And they give them a good cut of the pie, you see, big cut of the economic pie. Now, just look at Argentina as a case example here, right? The U.S. pushes the Macri business interests back into control, and first thing Macri and his boys do is they pay off the U.S. hedge funds, billions of dollars, and that means, okay, now you can come to New York, boys, and you can borrow some more money now that you paid off the Singers and the others, right? Paul Singer I'm talking about. And, of course, when they get the big loans from New York, the new loans, they skim off the top, they get rich. And if there's upheaval or discontent, then the U.S. Uses the CIA and the USAID and all the others to help them reestablish control. Right? That's the model. That's the U.S. model of political imperialism, military imperialism. Quite different from other models. But the big extraction of wealth from these countries by the U.S. occurs in two ways. One, by having U.S. corporations go and set up operations in these countries, and there's a lot of incentives for them to do so. The dollar is the global currency, is a great aid in doing so. And also financials, imperialism in the sense of interests get these countries and all indebted and pull out the wealth from interest payments, you see, and have the domestic state play the role of a tax gatherer to pay off the interest. So it's a new form of imperialism that's been working quite well in the U.S. So this is the U.S. model. And it's being confronted with the Chinese model. And which will it be? And we see, the surface confrontation of this in the trade war. And we'll see how the trade war turns out. Because if at the core of the trade war are these military technologies, well, then flip it around and you got a new Cold War. I think the trade war is a cover for the new Cold War. You know, under Obama, they talked about, the U.S. needs to pivot towards China. Well, it's already pivoted. The pivot's happened, right? And it's there. Okay, so we have this confrontation of these two different models. Trade is right now the point of the spear of the confrontation, you might say. Right? But, you know, you've heard about, I'm sure if you read the press and so forth, about the China and islands in the South China Sea and China building its, China's relationships, new relationships now with the Philippines and other erstwhile U.S. allies in the area as they begin to play off China and the U.S. against each other. Even Japan is now going to China looking for a new relationship, right? Okay. So, but what's the explanation for China's rise to a status in which it pretty much is, competing directly with the U.S. now? If you look at GDP as an indicator, not the best, but, U.S. GDP is $21 trillion. But the China GDP is like $11 trillion, rising fast. And if you reduced or adjusted the two GDPs according to the different price systems, then China would be as big as the U.S. That's called PPP parity, price adjustment of GDPs. Well, that's more art than fact. So $21 trillion, $11 trillion. China growing officially 6 to 7% a year, and the U.S. barely growing 2% a year, right? And that includes all the exaggerations of U.S. growth here this year under Trump. All right, so how will we explain the growth of China to this comparable level of the United States so that the United States is really worried? Well, the article in the New York Times doesn't really tell you much about that. Well, here's my interpretation of that, okay? Any country's long-term economic growth, any economist will tell you, depends on how they use their key resources. And those key resources are land, labor, and capital. By land, I mean not just the surface, the soil, the agriculture, and so forth. You know, I mean the resources under the ground. What kind of resources do they have? Are they readily available? Are they dependent on trade to get them? And, of course, water is a key resource and so forth. So, okay, so land, labor, very important, both skilled and unskilled and entrepreneurial labor for economic development. And as you get more developed, the skilled and entrepreneurial becomes more important. Capital. What are we talking about? We're talking about money capital here, investment capital to begin with. And then, of course, you have your stock of machinery and so forth, equipment. That's another form of capital. You know, capital is chameleon. It shifts form between money and physical forms. What can we say? How did China gather its land, labor, and capital in the last 35 years? You know, it took over a century for the U.S. to develop its land, labor, and capital. Of course, it had this magnificent land resource, unmatched anywhere in the world, and still had no labor. Had to import all the labor. That's why we had open immigration our whole history, okay? And capital, where did they get the capital? When it started out, the U.S. started out, there were no banks. Britain had kept all the capital for itself, and there was no capital in the country and no banks in the 1780s, and we had a terrible depression in the 1780s. Okay, maybe we'll return to that and explain how we got out of that. But the capital, money capital, for the U.S. development 19th century came from, guess where? Britain. Yeah, we fought a war with Britain, and then they turned around and they, from the 1820s on, even before that, pumped in massive amounts of money capital back into the U.S. economy to finance and extract profits from railroad development and agriculture development and industrial development. So a lot of the capital came from Britain itself. And of course, there were some discoveries of money capital with gold and silver in the U.S., because in those days, particularly before 1860, there was very little real currency as money. It was mostly gold and silver. Okay, so turning away from the U.S. back to China. Where did China get its money capital to finance this incredible 35 years of growth? Guess where it got it? It got it from the U.S. Yeah, just as Britain, our old enemy, gave it to us, the U.S. pump massive amounts of foreign direct investment and capital into China. And then the Europeans followed, and then the Japanese and Koreans, South Koreans followed. So that's where the Chinese got their initial major infusion of money capital for economic development. Okay. Now, what that meant was American companies just didn't hand over a check, right? When I say they massive money capital, they invested, they moved to China. Yes. After the 1980s or during the 1980s, you know, we started deindustrializing the U.S. And these companies started going offshore, the tax system and free trade. You see, that's what free trade is all about. It's so that U.S. corporations that move offshore can now send their stuff back and not pay a trade tax, a tariff on it. And we gave them tax cuts to move it in the first place, and then we gave them free trade tariff tax cuts to bring the products back. And, of course, the jobs went with the foreign direct investment. All right, so that's what free trade is about, and that's what a lot of the corporate investment tax cuts are about. And the U.S. moved massively into U.S. companies into China. Right? In fact, this is a fact that you're not going to hear much about. A lot of the trade deficit between the U.S. and China right now is really U.S. corporations in China imports to the U.S. I've seen figures as high as 49% of China's goods imports to the U.S. are from U.S. corporations in China or joint operations with Chinese corporations. In other words, foreign corporations. That might include Japan and South Korea, which also have done the same thing. You see, they moved a lot of their operations, big multinationals in those countries, into China itself. So maybe 49%. interesting figure, but you know, you don't hear Trump saying anything about that, does he? You know, you want to do something about the China trade, right? Tell these U.S. corporations to get their ass back here. And if they don't, and if they still want to import to the U.S., then slap a 50% tariff on just U.S. corporations importing from China to the U.S. Just them, right? You watch them close up shop, come back. But they're not going to do that, you see. No way, right? Now, as the U.S. corporations pump more and more money into China, and other corporations too, a lot of this money ends up in the Bank of China. You see, you go over there, you bring your dollars. I'm a company, right? And I want to set up shop. Well, I'm not going to pay my suppliers over there and my workers over there with dollars. I need Chinese currency and the yuan. So I'm going to take my U.S. dollars and go to the Bank of China. Deposit it there, and Bank of China is going to give me yuan that I can pay my suppliers and so forth. And that's how the Bank of China piles up its dollars, its short-term dollars and short-term liquidity assets and so forth. And other countries doing the same with dollars, because dollars are the global trading and reserve currency. Key cornerstone, by the way, of U.S. Economic empire, you know, the dollar as the trading and reserve currency. Okay, so China builds up over $1 trillion in U.S. Dollar, you know, denomination currencies and so forth. And I think their total of all currencies are like $3 trillion or something massive like that, right? Because their money capital is flowing into China, financing the manufacturing boom that occurs from the 90s on in China. Very low wage, low cost. So when U.S. and other multinational corporations exported back to the U.S., right, they charge a much higher price than they paid to get these things produced. And even so, it's lower cost for the American consumer than if they went and bought it themselves. And that's a double advantage to U.S. corporations because they offer U.S. workers low-cost imported goods, in other words, raises their real wages, so they don't have to give U.S. workers wage increases. And that allows them to destroy the unions without a big pushback because, you know, now the U.S. Worker puts more family members to work, works a couple jobs, right, and buys cheap stuff from Walmart, which is a Chinese company, since 85% of everything it sells comes from China. Okay. All right. So what we got here is $1.3 trillion. Now, why would the U.S. allow this to happen over several decades? You know, why did politicians not do something about it? This huge trade imbalance, you know, when we run a trade deficit, as we do with China, was it $475 billion, even bigger this year, that means net dollars are flowing out of the U.S. into China, right? And that's the source of the huge trade deficit. U.S. corporations and investors going over to China, taking their dollars with them and spending them in China to do business in China. And they end up at the Chinese Central Bank, right? All right, so why did U.S. do this? Make China rich. Well, the politicians do it because, and listen closely, because the dollars get recycled back to the U.S. There's $1.3 trillion left in China's central bank, but how many trillions got recycled back every year after year, so forth? Trillions, trillions more get recycled back as they buy, they, China, buys U.S. Treasury bonds. The U.S. politicians let this thing go because it means they can, the U.S. Treasury, the Fed that sells bonds on behalf of the Treasury, you know, can sell these bonds and get the dollar cash back from China. By the way, the U.S. does this with everybody, not just China. You know, Japan almost as much, and the OPEC, and so forth, Europe, and so forth, you know. This is called the twin deficits, all right? The trade deficit allows all this cash to come back to finance the U.S. budget deficit every year. And so much comes back that the U.S. can engage in wars since 2001 without raising taxes, the first time in its history. And at the same time, the U.S. can cut taxes on investors and corporations and the wealthy at the same time. Cut taxes, right? And finance wars at the same time. Never happened before. But it's this trade relationship with the world based on the dollar that allows the U.S. to do this, the twin deficits. And if it's all coming back, you know, you keep spending more on wars and you keep reducing your taxes for the rich because it's all going to come back in to fund the budget deficit, just selling more bonds. So the trade deficit fuels and feeds and enables the budget deficit to balloon. This all began under Reagan. This is all part of neoliberalism, you see. When most people talk about neoliberalism, they talk about austerity and so forth, and that's all true. But they totally miss the role of external policy, as it's called, trade policy, balance of payments policy, budgets, and so forth, as part of it as well. This was set up under Reagan, and it's gotten larger and larger ever since. Well, it's become unsustainable. It's not enough to finance the wars and the tax cuts anymore. That's why Trump is out there trying to introduce a neoliberalism 2.0 and squeeze even more from the trade deals from U.S. trading partners, not just China, but others as well. He's trying to squeeze more out of it, right? It's an indication that neoliberalism is in trouble. And we'll see whether Trump can reestablish it as a a new aggressive, virulent, more virulent neoliberalism 2.0. Well, you know, he already gave another $5 trillion in tax cuts to his buddies here. And now he's going to try to squeeze a little bit more here on the trade deal from foreign competition. You see, neoliberalism is an attack not only on the working classes and the middle class and the poor, it's an attack on foreign capitalist competitors at the same time. All right, I've got a book coming out in the spring called The Scourge of Neoliberalism, which talks about all this and more. All right. So China gets all this money capital. And the U.S. allows it to go on because it's very lucrative in terms of tax cuts and war financing. The U.S. allows China to have preferred nation trading rights, which is kind of like almost free trade. And it allows China to get into the World Trade Organization. And once that happened, of course, the Japanese and the South Koreans jumped into this game as well and are playing it with the U.S. All right. So that's where China gets all its money capital, or did. You know, it reaches a certain point where it can generate its own money capital, kind of like a takeoff. And that's been happening as well in the last decade or so. All right. So that's where the U.S., that has provided the capital factor to economic growth and development that explains a lot of what China has been able to accomplish. You know, once China is able to, as it has been since the late 90s, to become an export powerhouse, that generates foreign capital as well. It doesn't have to wait on U.S. corporations investing. The dollars flow in. Also from trade, you see. Okay. The other two factors, of course, are labor and land. Well, what about land? What does China have in terms of land? Well, they got ample coal for early industrial development. They have major trading relationships with the Middle East for oil. And they have certain other resources like rare earths, it's called, which are key for electronic and technological development. And most of it's located in China. So, you know, they have land, they have water, they got a lot of people. But so far, you know, it looks like they've been able to provide foodstuffs for their people, maybe not the on a scale and variety as in the U.S., but people aren't starving there anymore. Money capital, an important institution is banks that sort of funnel the money capital around, right? And whereas the U.S. has relied on some big private banks, in China you still have four very large public sector banks that control the money supply, the indigenous money supply, rather than the money supply flowing in from the West. And the Western banks have been kept at arm's length until recently here in China. So they've maintained control of their banking system while they've encouraged and still encourage inflow of money capital from offshore. That's played a big role in their economic development. What about labor? Well, they've been very rich in the labor factor. They've had millions of people come off of the rural inlands and go to the coast where the factories and the manufacturing largely exist. They haven't had to encourage immigration. It's been internal immigration, whereas in the U.S. we encourage immigration largely from Europe most of our history. So labor, unskilled, coming in from the rural area. Skilled, as we said, they have more college graduates than we do now. So they spend a lot of money on college expenditures and secondary education of a technical variety, closely related to business, not so much liberal arts or anything like that. And that's all about creating skilled labor, including entrepreneurial labor. And they send a lot of their business people abroad to U.S. and Europe, particularly the U.S., higher education. You know, you look at a lot of public universities in the U.S., very, very large percentage of Chinese students, Chinese national students in these institutions. In fact, University of California, I think, has, what, 9 campuses, and I think like 5 or 6 of those campuses have a majority of Chinese. Now, they're not all Chinese nationals, but huge overrepresentation of that particular ethnic group. And, of course, now they're fighting to get into Harvard and places like that. So, you know, this is they've been very smart and sending people abroad, and then they learn the Western way of business, and then they come back to China. So skilled labor, right? That's helped them develop, particularly now that technology and highly skilled is the key. So capital they've been able to gather, land they have pretty good, not great, but pretty good resources. The big limitation is oil that they have to import, and labor. Well, that's land, labor, capital. That explains it. But, you know, in 35 years, it took us a century in the U.S. to put that combination together. Not exactly the same. You know, whereas we had a shortage of labor, China had excess of labor. Whereas we had a shortage of capital got from Britain, they had a shortage of capital they got from the U.S., Japan, and others. And land resource, the U.S., of course, had much greater land resources. No one has matched the land resources availability in the U.S. and still. What about policy? Has policy played a role in China's development? You bet. Right? Whereas the U.S. has been making some false steps here over the last 30-some years, the Chinese have played it pretty smart. Pretty smart. China's fiscal policy emphasizes infrastructure development. You know, we keep talking about that here and don't do anything. Investment is 40% of their GDP, and much of that is government investment. In the U.S., it averages 10%, and at times it's been as low as 5 or 6, and 1 year was nothing, and virtually no direct government investment. So, you know, over the long term, that 40% has a big impact on economic growth. Big percentage, total GDP, 40%. A lot of it goes into housing and commercial construction. For a long time, there's been a boom. You see, housing and construction is the quick boost to GDP. And that, too, has been driven by government, local government in China. Infrastructure-driven and investment-driven by the national government, local government, and of course, we don't have that kind of emphasis, local or national, here in the U.S. At the same time, China has kept its state-owned enterprises, has not denationalized them, has kept them as a core, in some cases propping them up, but nonetheless refusing to have a total market economy. It's mixed in that sense. It's allowed billionaires, but kept them on a tight leash. If they step out of line, or if they engage in corruption, they get shot. You know, what did we do with our billionaires, our banker billionaires here in 2008-09? Well, we certainly didn't shoot any. In fact, I can't think of anyone except that guy Madoff, who stole from other capital investors, who've gone to jail. None of them. In other words, we give a signal it's okay to behave this way. In China, if you step out of line and behave this way, you know, you step up against the wall. Okay. I'm not advocating that, but I'm just saying that's the way they do. So, you know, the capitalists, as long as they can make their billions without violating the party and the government, they're allowed to do so. But there are limits clearly defined there. Okay. We've got a policy in China. If you look at what's happened since the 1990s, Japan went bust in the early 1990s, financial speculation, debt, and bust. And when it did in 1990s, the South Asian countries looked more to China as China began developing. And as Japan recovered some in the late 90s, it too started redirecting towards China. It became a race after WTO between U.S., Japanese, and South Koreans, and even Europeans, to invest in China. The 1997 Asian meltdown of currencies in South Asia in particular also had the result of these countries thinking about orienting to China. We see Philippines now very much orienting. China played the crises of the West, the economic crises of the West, fairly cleverly. And the most clever was, of course, in 2008-09, the big crash. Here's a big reason why China has developed it so fast here, particularly in the last decade. When the 2008-09 crash occurred, right, what happened was China engaged in a fiscal stimulus, a massive spending that was like 15 to 17% of his GDP. Contrast that to Obama's recovery program in 2009, barely 5% of GDP, and it really was tax cuts and money given to the states to spend that they didn't. Well, no wonder the U.S. got such a terrible, slow recovery of its real economy afterwards. Not the financial economy, because the Federal Reserve, the bank, pumped trillions into the banks and investors. You see, that's why they recovered so fast. But the real recovery barely recovered, because the composition of the Obama and the magnitude of Obama recovery program was so poor, contrasted to China's 15, 17% direct fiscal stimulus. Well, China boomed. And if its manufacturing boomed with the boom, which it did, right, then China's demand for commodities from emerging markets also boomed. You know, while we were struggling 2008, 10, 11, Europe falling into a double-dip recession between 2011, 13, and Japan having three recessions after 2008-09, the emerging markets were booming. That's because China demand for the emerging markets, goods, their commodities, boomed. So China and the rest of the world were recovering robustly. Big difference between the fiscal policy of China as the driver and monetary policy in the U.S. as the driver, the Federal Reserve, pumping QE and all that money, trillions, into the economy and hoping that the banks and investors would spill down a little bit to the real economy, which they didn't. They pumped it into stocks and bonds and foreign exchange and derivatives and made even greater profits. Or they sent it offshore to the commodity-producing emerging markets, you know, where returns were greater. Or they sent it to China, where things were booming, right? That's why, you know, that Federal Reserve Bank trillions had very little effect in the U.S. It flowed out, or flowed into financial assets. I've been talking about that a long time. Well, China didn't do that. China pumped it into investment, real investment. Well, a lot of that was property investment, caused some bubbles there in China. And China attempted then to develop a stock market even more, and that got a little out of hand, and they had to put a damper on that. And to some extent, you know, China's fiscal policy aimed at local construction and everything has resulted in multiple property real estate booms and busts. Right. In terms of employment, though, if you're expanding manufacturing, you're expanding jobs that are decent paid, even according to Chinese standards. Whereas in the U.S. during this period, we were cutting millions and millions of manufacturing jobs and construction jobs after the bust in 2008. Right. China, over several decades, you know, creating tens of millions of manufacturing jobs, whereas the U.S. Creating service jobs, contingent jobs, meaning part-time temp mostly. Big difference in employment creation, the quality of employment creation. The U.S. monetary policy was primary. We engaged in austerity on the fiscal side, cut $1 trillion out of spending in 2011, another $500 billion in 2013. We didn't cut defense, by the way, though. All right. So the policies employed, the trade policies, the employment policies, right, monetary fiscal policies in China enabled it to continue growing at 7, 8, 9% after the crash, whereas the U.S. was barely growing 1%. Barely. Okay. Both economies, however, have loaded up on debt as a result. Chinese debt is 250% of its GDP, which is about $25 trillion, roughly. Okay. Local government debt, helping to finance construction, right? And national government debt as well, and private debt in China. And the U.S., of course, has 25, 30, probably close to 30 trillion debt, 21 trillion government debt. That's not counting state and local government, pension debt, so forth, or household debt, which is, if you count mortgages and so forth, $13.5 trillion. So U.S. has loaded up in even more debt than the Chinese. And we hear a lot of the problem with the Chinese debt. They're both loaded up dangerously on debt here. Right. Okay, so, you know, that's the difference in the picture here of what's happened and why China has caught up to the U.S., in some ways even surpassing the U.S. now, right? Hasn't relied on monetary policy, in other words, give money to bankers and investors and hope it trickles down. Has relied on fiscal policy. Fiscal policy is spending, not tax cuts for the rich. Monetary policy to, you know, finance the fiscal spending, and the massive fiscal spending has meant, you know, that the debt has risen in China as well, particularly local debt. But a big difference in fiscal versus monetary policy is the lead, whether the government's going to be involved in infrastructure and investment, or whether we're going to leave it totally up to the private sector in the U.S., pumps its money into financial assets instead. Big difference, big difference. And you do that, emphasize real investment and fiscal spending over several decades, versus monetary policy and fiscal austerity, spending austerity and tax cuts in the U.S., well, then you get the big difference in the growth rates and the convergence here in economic power. And, you know, if you look at what China is now doing, China is attempting to expand its economic influence, right? It's got the IMF to agree to consider its currency, the yuan, as part of the trading currencies of the world. That's the first step to challenging the dollar. It's established an Asian Investment Development Bank here, loans to the other countries in its sphere in Asia, forming a common market with them. The One Belt, One Road initiative, which is a big infrastructure funneling to tie China's economy directly to Russia and Europe and the Middle East without having to rely on on the oceans, which the U.S. can blockade pretty easily because it has much larger navy. That's what One Belt, One Road is about. A lot of loans to a lot of these countries, which their domestic elites skim off the top, you know, and get rich over, forming a deeper relationship with Russia, which means tech transfer from Russia to China. The same with U.S., Japan, and South Korea, tech transfer, which now, of course, the trade deal is trying to break. The U.S. is trying to break, right? China's been investing heavily in southern and eastern Europe, right? It helped Greece out by buying its main port, Piraeus. It's established a sovereign wealth fund to fund offshore projects, right? It has a deep relationship with commodity producers in South America, including Brazil, Venezuela, Ecuador, Peru. It's attempted to establish relationship in Africa, particularly the Horn of Africa there, oil and trade. So this has all got the U.S. Quite worried, you see, quite worried. Well, the U.S. has been pursuing this, let's get our minority rich even richer, and not ensuring investment in the U.S. and what's happened is China has been steadily pursuing these policies and a growth model that's brought them up to parity just about, I would say, with the U.S. And if you look at patents in these key technology areas, U.S. still leads, but the only one that's close is China. The rest of the world's left behind. Europe is finished economically, you know, and now when the next recession, the Italian banks go under, and Greek banks too, and Brexit happens, you know, Europe can't really compete. It's got a lot of wealth and everything, but it can't get together with an effective joint policy strategy. The only thing keeping it going is Germany, and now Germany is slowing down as global trade slows down. So, and of course, Japan is trying to find a new relationship with China, but it's still totally linked to the United States. And that's the position we have. That's what we got as Trump meets with Xi here in Buenos Aires next week. And we will see whether we get a real trade war coming out of that. I think it's going to take another 6 weeks to tell, but we will have a show next week on Buenos Aires and the G20 meeting.